Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Richard Joiner. I succeeded Joe Lamb as chair of the SBS Executive Committee last year, so it's my privilege to welcome you all here this evening. Before I introduce our guest speaker, may I just say a little bit about the format of the evening. Mrs. Beckett will shortly give her address, and then there will be the buffet, which will be held on the fifth floor of this building. And then no later than 8:30, we will come back down here for the SBS annual general meeting, those of you who are involved with that. It's a very great pleasure this evening for SBS to welcome as our guest speaker, the President of the Board of Trade, the Right Honourable Margaret Beckett. Mrs. Beckett was educated at Notre Dame High School in Norwich and Manchester College of Science and Technology. She's a metallurgist who then spent a period with AEI in Manchester, and then moving to the University of Manchester, where she practiced as an electron microscopist. She thus has much better credentials in science than any of her predecessors in this post. She soon, however, became actively involved in the Labour Party, winning the Lincoln seat in the October 1974 election. In that parliament, she rose to be Parliamentary Undersecretary of State at the then Department of Education and Science. In 1979, she lost the Lincoln seat, but was returned for Derby South in a by-election in 1983, a seat which she still holds. In opposition, Mrs. Beckett has held a wide range of roles, eventually becoming deputy leader and then acting leader during the sad interregnum following the death of John Smith. Incidentally, John Smith was himself the guest speaker at our AGM some 3 or 4 years ago. And no one who heard him then will doubt what a great loss he is to our national political life. Following the May New Labour landslide, Margaret Beckett became President of Board of Trade, where she has a wide range of responsibilities, and where her ministerial team includes John Battle, who has special responsibilities for science. We were, however, very pleased by earlier announcement that Mrs. Beckett intends to take her cabinet role as representing science very seriously, and we look forward to hearing her talk, which is entitled A Science and Engineering Base for the 21st Century. Mrs. Beckett.
Thank you very much for inviting me here this evening to take part in your AGM. I will not disguise from you that it was an invitation I really felt quite unable to refuse. For one thing, I have a brother-in-law who is one of your members, and have many friends who feel very passionately, as I do myself, about the concerns that your organisation was founded to address. As has just been said, science does have a very high profile in my cabinet responsibilities. In fact, I put it first among the issues for which I take personal responsibility within the department. And so I very much welcome the opportunity to say a little to a group that shares our concern to promote the well-being of our science and engineering base, and to outline, at least in part, the context within which we see that base developing as we approach the new century. As has been mentioned already, I have something of a background in science and engineering. And so, of course, that does mean that I do take quite genuinely a personal interest in this aspect of our department's work. And while responsibility for science matters on a day-to-day basis rests with John Battle as Minister of State, and of course that in itself is a higher level within government than was represented within the previous administration, he is Minister of State for Science, Energy and Industry. He is the first person to point out that the order is deliberate, and that there is a science thread running through all of his portfolio. My view is that in the UK, we should be seeking, as an overall approach, as a matter of economic and social policy, to become a country in which we aim to earn our living in the world through producing goods and services of high quality, and that it is on the basis of the living that we earn on, through that approach, that we can afford the public services that are of a standard that the public need and deserve. But it's also my view that the road to some of this quality is that we should try to see Britain as a high technology economy, offering its citizens a high standard of living not just in terms of income, but other aspects of the quality of life. We are, as a new government, committed to strengthen the voice of science across government, and to begin our work to strengthen the science base and capitalise on the benefits that science and technology can bring, particularly to the economy. I think it is common ground that Britain continues to have a very strong science and engineering base across a wide range of disciplines. That is quite an achievement when it has been ensured, despite considerable concerns over a long period of time about issues which have arisen around the problems of funding. Let me say at once that this government does attach great importance to the strength and continuity of the science base. I know that some commentators have suggested concerns that we would deliberately run down that science base or drive our universities and institutes into short-term contract research. Those fears are entirely unjustified, and the suggestion that we would intend to go further down the path of short-termism is simply not true. In fact, one of the basic ways in which we believe in a whole variety of respects that this government will differ from the last is our heartfelt, explicitly stated ambition to be a government that looks to the long term, far beyond the perspective of one parliament or even of one government. That is our overall ambition. It is not an ambition that relates specifically to our attitude to the science base, although, of course, it is one that certainly counters the suggestion that we might be particularly short-term in our approach to that base. Second, of course, we do recognise all too clearly the fears that again have often been expressed in the science and engineering community that there has been too great a bias of recent years towards science which is particularly related to practical outcomes and indeed to industrial development. I bow to no one in my respect both for the huge importance of using to the best possible advantage the scientific knowledge in which over the years Britain has been so rich and the innovative and inventive skills and curiosity of our people. But equally, while I recognise the importance of putting our science to use and the fact that we've often neglected that in the past, I recognise too the importance of basic science, of curiosity-driven science, undertaken without some specific end in view, some specific reward, undertaken just in order to try to find the answer to a fascinating question. I have no doubt at all the view that all our important discoveries have come ultimately from what is often termed blue skies research, is in fact absolutely valid and very much based on our practical experience. So I share the concern that we mustn't overlook the needs of basic science when we seek to make the science discoveries that we have more relevant, to make them more exploited with our engineering base. Going back for a second to the science and engineering base itself, I recognise too the concerns that have been raised about the infrastructure supporting that base and that endeavour. Concerns raised not just from the academic community, but also from the CBI and from the industry, the world of industry. The problem was confirmed most recently in the Deering report, where it was suggested that we've lived for too long off past investment, great though the achievements of the past may have been. But it's also clear, as I said a moment ago, that we have to capitalise better on the science and engineering base that we have to ensure that it's better connected with users, both in established industries and in the growth industries of the future. And while international comparisons do imply that British universities are among the most willing to enter partnerships with industry and other users, we're exploring whether we can do more. All too often when this point is made, it comes across as if the criticism is of the university or the academic world in not seeking to make contact with users in industry and outside. My impression, frankly, is that at least as much a problem, perhaps even a greater problem, is to get large sectors of British industry themselves to take innovation more seriously, to to take a positive view of R&D, as our competitors appear to do, and in consequence, a reluctance to reach out to the university and academic base of scientific research and learn what more can be done together to bring that research closer to the user. Certainly, the continual uncertainty caused by annual public expenditure rounds hasn't created a very stable background for long-term planning. I'm well aware of the concerns that the financial circumstances inherited by the present government have caused and will cause difficulties for the science base. You will be aware, I know, of the clear commitment made before the election by the then Shadow Chancellor that we would in fact stick to the public expenditure settlement that we inherited and that we would stick to the settlement as it was set out over the succeeding 2 years. And it is on that basis, I know, and quite understandably, that concerns have been expressed. But while clearly that does raise anxieties for people within the scientific community, I hope you will also recognise the other side of that decision, which is that we use the basis that present public expenditure settlement gives us to establish a comprehensive spending review. One of the perhaps somewhat advantageous offsets of accepting the spending round for the given year that is in existence is that the energy, the time, and the effort that would have been spent on a public spending round for this year can now, and indeed can only now, go into discussion of what ought to be the government's priorities, what ought to be their overall approach to public spending for future years. This gives us a unique opportunity. I rather think an opportunity that has never been available to a government of any previous colour, not only an opportunity that will be unique within the lifetime of this government as far as we ourselves are concerned. Because what it is enabling us to do, but what it is also forcing us to do, is to look better at how the amounts of public money that we do now spend fulfill and give expression to the government's overall priorities. It's forcing us to look within departments at what priorities are for public spending as originally planned, but it's also forcing us to look across the whole of government at how we use our resources and what decisions that suggests for the longer term. Obviously, that is a substantial task and a very serious one. It is one which is neither lightly undertaken nor easy to carry out, and it means that we are not in a position to prejudge the outcome of these discussions and decisions. But it does offer a chance of a kind that has never been available in previous years, to look at the overall level of funding, to look at how that funding is used, whether it is used efficiently, and whether it's directed effectively to deliver the government's strategic objectives with particular emphasis on the longer term. So for us, it means looking at priorities between areas of research, looking at the trade-off between volume and capital, and between selectivity and breadth of coverage, looking even more than has been done in the recent past as to how we ensure that whatever research is done is properly funded rather than being inadequately funded, and in general, making us look at all the approaches of supplementing the public funding of basic infrastructure through the partnerships that are already available. Partnerships including joint funding with other users, public-private partnerships in cases where the private sector is willing and able to provide a service or facility to the science and engineering base, perhaps in conjunction with a university or research council establishment, and looking too at the role of charities in biomedical research. So looking at those individual reviews, we will then be in a better position to prioritise expenditure across government, and I do genuinely believe that this offers us a great opportunity, not merely as those engaged within government, whether as officials or ministers, to ourselves focus on how we use our funding and how we try to develop our science and engineering base, but to draw into that discussion and into the context of what Britain needs in the long term in its science and engineering base, those of our colleagues who would not normally be engaged in these discussions, except in so far as they directly impinge upon the work of their own particular department. We have said on many previous occasions that we would use this and other opportunities to bring science to the heart of government. I certainly share strongly the view that science must permeate into all government departments and their development of policy. That is not just a matter of getting colleagues across government to focus on Britain's scientific needs and what our science can contribute, but it also means looking at how government departments themselves use the scientific knowledge that is available. You may be aware that Sir Robert May, the Chief Scientific Advisor, published guidelines on the use of scientific advice in policymaking earlier this year. In fact, using scientific principles and evidence at all in policymaking might be a departure for some, and certainly would be a departure within the House of Commons, where the difference between evidence and opinion is all too frequently little understood. But Sir Robert's guidelines propose a series of best practice measures. They include increased involvement of the wider scientific community in the decision-making process, the publication of data relating to particular issues as early as possible. And I see it as part of my role as Cabinet Minister for Science to ensure that departments and indeed agencies, like, for example, the planned new Food Standards Agency, take account of the principles that he has identified in his guidelines in their use of science and technology. I'm pleased to say that we've ensured that a minister has been designated within each department with special responsibility for ensuring that that department's general procedures for taking account of scientific advice are consistent with the guidelines. And in addition, departmental chief scientists will be reporting regularly to Sir Robert May on how the guidelines are being implemented and of any key issues of which other departments should be aware. Those measures are, of course, only a start, but I hope they do indicate that we do have a commitment in a variety of practical ways to try and ensure that science plays its full role in the wide range of decisions that are taken across government. I also share the view that I know, again, widely held in the scientific community, that we have to take science to the general public. Despite the exciting opportunities that new developments in research offer, they have the potential to increase public disquiet and distrust of academic researchers and industry. And there's also a risk of increasing scepticism of the government's ability to protect the public's interests. In some areas, of course, that public disquiet stems straightforwardly from fears over safety, justified or otherwise. In others, they stem also from questioning about whether all parties are taking seriously the ethical implications of future development. These fears and distrusts could have serious implications over the acceptance of new food products or medical procedures. And one example is the public's concern about and rejection of irradiated foods. So it's essential, not only for this reason, but for the democratic process itself, that the public is properly, impartially, and as fully as we can achieve, informed about activities in science, and that government maintains its credibility for reaching decisions based on the best possible and informed advice. Increasing public understanding of science and the appreciation of factors to be taken into account in these issues is a long process, one in which we must all participate and one in which we all have much to learn. And that is part of the focus of the guidelines that Sir Robert May has sought to disseminate across government. It's all too easy, and this applies just as much within government as it does with the general public. It is all too easy for people to look to scientists for the answer, for the categorical reassurance that something meets the test that they have in mind 100%. And that is part of what I mean when I talk and what Sir Robert means when he talks about getting across the issue of how we evaluate and how we understand evidence. People getting across the acceptance to the public that there is never going to be a 100 or a 150% answer to every question. It is part of getting more mature judgment of the fruits of scientific research and endeavour. We did make a pre-election commitment to work with others active in the field to take forward public understanding and appreciation of science, engineering and technology activities, and John Battle is currently working on new plans to involve the general public in such issues, as he announced at the BA Festival in September. We recognise too that the key feature of the work of the science and engineering base is its key resource, its people. Not only the trained graduates, postgraduates and postdoctoral researchers flowing out of the system into other areas of the economy, but the dynamic resource that's the combined knowledge and skills of all those who work at present within the scientific and engineering base. It's also a vital network, a means of keeping abreast of and understanding the potential output of the research undertaken outside the United Kingdom. Here too, I sometimes feel that we perhaps don't take sufficient advantage of the opportunities that are available to us, and that too applies very much to people within our industrial community as much as, and perhaps far more than, to people within the academic world itself. This country certainly needs the right supply of highly qualified scientists and engineers, not just to prosper, but to survive. Getting that right has never been, and never will be, I suspect, a straightforward exercise. There are no magic answers to the problems that have been identified, few that have not been explored in the past. But I believe we continue to need a change of approach at all levels of the education system, not least of which, in my humble opinion, is an increased emphasis on the fact that science can be fun and that science contributes not merely, as some enthusiasts, for example, for environmental concerns seem today to fear, not just to sometimes helping to create the problems, but to being the only means of actually solving those problems as we identify them, whatever their source. But there are two specific issues that I just want to highlight. It's always the case at any scientific gathering, including, I fear, if I may say so with great respect, even this one, that when you look at the ratio of men to women at such occasions, we run the risk of wasting the talents of half the population. Among the biological sciences and medicine, there's now a much more healthy situation among undergraduates, but the physical sciences and engineering are still finding it difficult to attract young women. I know from personal experience the excitement and enjoyment of a career in the physical sciences and engineering, and very much welcomed initiatives like the recent launch of a handbook entitled Cracking It, to encourage more women to enjoy a scientific career. You may know too that there's been some disquiet over a recent study of the outcome of the Swedish MRC fellowship competition in 1995, which showed a marked bias in favour of male candidates. In the light of that report, the Director General of Research Councils has asked the Research Council chief executives to report on the success rate for their fellowships. Overall, I'm pleased to say that the success rates were very similar, although, as I suppose you'd expect with relatively small numbers, there were variations from year to year. But taking this one stage further, the Medical Research Council, in a joint study with the Wellcome Trust, is examining one of its fellowship schemes in more detail to check the quality is indeed what they would expect. And the outcome, I understand, will be published next month. The Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council is also undertaking a study of the relative quality of applicants to their junior fellowship scheme, and we are today publishing the figures, and I've asked the DGRC to ensure that the success rates for both grants and fellowships are now monitored and reported on an annual basis. But while I approach with some hesitation even the hint of seeming to endorse the suggestion that in any way at all this is in some way partly the fault of women themselves, it does seem nevertheless to be the case that the low application rate is the really worrying thing. An application rate which is itself significantly below the proportion of women in the relevant community. And so it does seem that we do still need to look specifically at the situation within the academic community as such. Last week, my department's development unit on women in science, engineering and technology hosted a conference to disseminate the results of a project called Winning Women. This project was funded by the Scottish Higher Education Funding Council to identify examples of best practice in Scottish universities in access, participation and progression of women in science and engineering. The challenge now is to ensure that we reap benefit from this study by encouraging wider adoption of those examples of best practice. And my department's unit will be working with colleagues in the Department for Education and Employment and the funding councils to take this forward. I also want to make a more general point. Contract research staff in universities and research institutes are an important group of people. In many respects, they're the powerhouse of the science base, and they have a great deal to contribute outside as well as inside research and academia. But I have no doubt that problems with the career management and development, indeed, I think some would argue the lack of career management and development, have tainted the image of academia and science more generally, and may also have adversely affected the transfer of talent and technology from the science base to the wider economy. The Research Careers Concordat between the research councils, CVCP, and other bodies, I hope will provide a framework within which to bring about change for the better. My department actively supports that agreement, and in September at the British Association meeting, I announced related key principles that government departments are endorsing. And most recently, as you will probably know, the OST has been closely involved with the Concordat signatories in setting up a new group headed by Sir Gareth Roberts to push forward the Concordat's implementation. I want to see practical solutions to these problems, and that's why I'm delighted that the group's membership is widely drawn from the higher education sector, bringing together expertise from personnel, the career service, finance, administration, research management, the unions, and research funders. It's something that is quite unusual in the scope of the participants. And there are examples of good practice for the group to identify, build on, and disseminate. There's experience, possibly even resource, to share between universities, research institutes, and government laboratories. In short, there is a potential mechanism here to generate ever-widening endorsement of good practice among employers and funders of research. But although, as I said earlier, I recognize to the full the importance of basic strategic and strategic research, that alone can't deliver our vision for the future, because the ideas generated have to be taken forward into new products, production processes, and services. We still need to strengthen the existing links between the science base, industry, and government, and forge a new partnership. And I know that Save British Science has been active in exploring this area, even if it was perhaps in part to seek allies. Links between the public services and the science and engineering base are already good, but much more needs to be done with the business community and particularly with small and medium-sized enterprises. We're looking at how best to develop that interface and examine whether there are particular problems with SMEs. I'm conscious of the growing evidence that it is particularly within small and medium-sized companies where the greatest value might derive from having people with a science and engineering background and in continuing touch with that world, and yet where it is perhaps least likely or too often to occur to the personnel person if they are large enough to have that facility, or indeed to the owner, as the case may be, the degree to which this can contribute to the development and work of their organisation. And of course, we have too, the Foresight Project. Since taking office, I've sought to put Foresight at the heart of business competitiveness. It brings together business, the science base, and government to explore emerging opportunities in markets and technologies, and so helps secure sustained competitive advantage in the longer term, which is something which is an overall goal for my department. We want to drive forward the Foresight programme, which had, I recognise, somewhat ground to a halt, so that companies themselves can improve their competitiveness, innovate and be successful by working in partnership with the science base. Again, I understand the concerns that too much concentration on foresight as a process might push public funding of research too much towards the short term and threaten blue skies research. We are determined to make sure that that is not the case. This issue was certainly highlighted at the outset of the process, and the report indeed of the Foresight Steering Committee itself made it plain that they see the need to retain a broad range of the UK's support for excellent basic research, particularly by selectively targeting the best people as judged by their peers. So while Foresight has an important input into determining strategic priorities, there are other important criteria for detailed decisions on basic science projects. And it's essential against that background that funding decisions are taken on the basis of quality. I have already announced plans to run another Foresight exercise beginning in 1999, and I hope that SBS can help us to learn from the past as the Office of Science and Technology draws together ideas on how that examination might be structured. There are a whole range of important issues facing us all as we look at science policy for a new millennium. And it's because there are so many genuinely important issues, but also so many complex issues to address, that we're not looking for simple solutions or for knee-jerk reactions. This will place real demands on us as government, both to promote the health of the science and engineering base as a whole and to fund basic and strategic research. But no matter what we can achieve, there will continue to be a need for selectivity and prioritisation, and this will always, I suspect, mean hard choices both within the science budget and across government. That's why it's so important to continue to build partnerships between the science and engineering base and potential users, in particular the business community. It's also why it's so important to foster and develop public awareness and understanding of the work of the science base, public awareness and understanding of the need to establish which your own organisation was founded to save and to support and to give success to British science. John Battle and I look forward to continuing to develop the discussions we've had with our governmental colleagues and with the scientific community over the months ahead. We look forward to, in the longer term, as we see developments following on the work of the Comprehensive Spending Review, to work with that community within whatever constraints we have to face in the climate of the day, to develop together the science and engineering base that Britain will need if we are to succeed as people and as an economy in the next century. Thank you.
President, thank you very much indeed, both on behalf of the audience, on behalf of Save British Science, for a thought-provoking and thoughtful address. I think there are many things there that the audience will have heard with considerable interest and appreciation, not least the commitment to retain and to increase the importance of science at the heart of government. I think there are a number of challenges there, certainly relating to the forthcoming Foresight exercise that we will certainly, SBS as an organisation, will hope to respond to. We recognise, of course, that the Comprehensive Spending Review means that you can perhaps tell us little about some of the things that are concerning us most at the present time, and we hope that when perhaps that is completed you will agree to come and talk to us again and we can see what has happened at that point. Thank you very much indeed for being with us this evening. Thank you.